Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. Our guest today, we've got a good guest today. His name is Chris Dorward. He spent a little over 4 years in the Marines as a Seaburn Marine and had some pretty interesting career trajectories from there. Became a police officer and undercover narcotics detective for over 10 years. Moved into real estate and is also the founder of the Texas Valor Project. So welcome, Chris. Yes,
thank you guys for having me.
It's a huge resume.
Yeah, thank you.
You've done some things.
I like things. To stay excited.
It like really went from military to first responder to philanthropist.
Yeah.
Businessman and philanthropist.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So let's rewind it all the way back and kind of dig into, pre-9/11 enlistment.
Okay. So went in 2000, had no idea we were going to go to war. Mm-hmm. Marine Corps was the only option for me. Didn't interview anybody else. Went straight in and didn't even choose really what I was going to do. I walked in, I just watched the movie The Rock with Nick Cage, and I said, I want to do what Nick Cage does. And they're like, you're the NBC guy, which later turned to Seaburn. So I could have looked at other options, maybe some things that would have been more fun or useful in later in life. That doesn't really relate to the civilian sector unless you want to work in a lab. So,
sure.
Prior to that, I was not the best student. So it was the hardest thing I'd done at the time, education-wise, was going through that school, learning azimuths and platting and all that kind of stuff. So fast forward from that, I ran a lot of recruit gas chambers. So all the new guys coming to the Marine Corps got my experience and nasal cleansing of CS gas. And
what's a favorite story in the gas chamber? There's got to be one.
There's so many. It's so hard to say. Just
or
watching
commonalities. Like, yeah, what do you see consistently across the board? I know that one is just the most hilarious type of training event to watch.
So for the enlisted guys, going through the chamber is a very memorable experience, especially in boot camp, and watching the drill instructors thrash them. We burn so much CS in the recruit chamber that it's a fog. You can't see. And when you get in the fleet, it's a mist, right? It's not that bad. But watching the drill instructors thrash the recruits was awesome. And, we'd do it all. You get immune to it to where I can take my mask off and just walk around and talk to them. And you look like a god walking around. You just have an immunity. But the best part, and most people don't know, is once you're in the fleet, all the officers, the brass, go last because they want us to burn all the CS. Okay. What they don't know is that we know that they know that. So we save all the CS to use on the officers.
Perfect.
So little trick of the trade there. Yeah. We smoke the officers. The brass always, I love making them cough and gag and clear their sinuses from their anus to their nose. It was perfect.
You're going to earn this, sir.
Yes, yeah. So that was a lot of fun.
That
was more fun torturing the officers.
Yeah.
Especially the field level officers. They were fun to trick.
I can imagine. So it was... Next.
Yeah. So we, from there went in, we started preparing for war right after 9/11.
Sure.
That was a very interesting day. Started with football practice, then rolled into, where are we going? What are we doing? Trying to make a phone call. My old Nokia 6160 wouldn't ring out to anybody because all the phone systems were down because everybody's calling. We prepared for war and then we deployed to Kuwait right around the end of 2002. It seems like it was 3 years ago, but it wasn't. And we just waited for the word. And one of the days I'll never forget is we're sitting on the border of Kuwait and Iraq, and they started launching Scuds at us or whatever missiles they were launching, and we just waited for a response, and there was no response. We're like, we got to get them. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one of my favorite days, best 4th of July in history for me, was watching the entire horizon light up in white. And it was nighttime and it was as bright as daytime. And we targeted all their missile launching sites. And that's like, okay, we're going. This is going to be real. And from there, it was, I was a corporal, platoon sergeant, corporal at the time. And we invaded at night and played bumper cars all the way up because our night vision obviously then was nowhere near what it is today.
Yeah.
So we're just bumping cars all the way up. And kind of a fun story. We're going in, not getting shot at. And one of the platoon commanders or the convoy commanders says, we can't see anything. Turn your lights on. So the whole convoy turns all the lights on and tracers are coming from everywhere. And it was like, turn the lights off, turn the lights off, turn the lights off. So, yeah. So remember, I was a Pogue unit. So we're not the most tactically trained guys. Sure.
Well, it's also the initial invasion where tactics don't have SOPs at this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Figuring it out.
What's interesting about where we were, our convoy was actually the convoy that the show on HBO, Generation Kill, was filmed on. So the Recon guys came back and got attached to us. So that was great when we had Recon guys attached to us.
Sure.
They were miserable. And that show, Generation Kill, to me is just so cool because it's told from the Lance Corporal up, and all other war shows and movies are told from the brass down. Mm-hmm. So that's why like most field grade officers hate the show, because it makes them look like idiots. But that's how we looked at them. They were morons because they're not telling us what they're doing. So anyway, I digress. That was really fun because back and watching that, I didn't watch it until about 4 years ago. And I was like, wow, yeah, that was us. And
yeah.
It's pretty fun.
I see myself.
And relatively accurate. Anyway, so I'm not a combat guy. I mean, we were shot at a couple times. I never saw heavy combat. But one of the most beautiful things I can remember is supporting those guys. Mm-hmm. And in NBC, we had Sinators, which are just really overpriced, shitty pressure washers that create hot water. So right after the Battle of Nasiriyah, we set up our Sinators because we weren't sure if there was going to be a chemical attack or not. So we already had the decontamination area set up. We just modified it and turned it into hot showers. So
there you go.
The guys coming back, I mean, I'll never forget the faces of those guys. Just dirty, bloody.
Yeah.
The 1,000-yard stare and then their face when they came out of a hot shower was that was amazing.
Yeah, so, being able to provide that to those guys.
Small comfort goes a long way.
Yeah, and it was just an idea that turned into something that ended up being really great.
I bet they were very thankful for that.
Probably.
Very thankful.
Yeah.
So what's your role technically as a Seaburn advisor out there, or a Seaburn Marine out there? I know during the early days, everyone was wearing MOP gear because they were afraid of NBC attacks, right?
Yeah, well, we were super prepared. So all of our MOP gear was woodland in the desert.
Yeah.
So
matches.
That was awesome.
Well.
and the majority of people, we had some that was desert. How we didn't prepare for that, I don't know. But and our Humvees had no armor.
Sandbag armor. Yeah.
We didn't even have sandbags. We had a canvasback Humvee with no doors, no roof, high back, and had a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle in the back that was pinned to the floor the entire time. But anyway, our role was to be in the situation of a chemical attack, was to take command of the situation.
Okay.
And we did. When those scuds I was telling you about went up right before we invaded, that was the only time that I had to take control and do, the junior Marine has to unmask, and nobody wants to be the guy like, hey, guess what? You're the private.
You've been selected.
Take your mask off, I remember the brass on that were not happy with relinquishing control to a corporal, but that's SOP.
That's
what
we
did.
So,
on
so is that really a test? You make someone take their mask off? And
absolutely. Yeah. And we had canaries too. So, the old canary in a box.
Yeah.
When the canary drops, put your mask on. Luckily, we only had one die and it wasn't because it was a gas attack. But the canary just died. I never really got it. Yeah. I never got to exercise what
any VX gas exposure like The Rock or what?
Man, I was really hoping.
Home.
No, that's an awful thing. But
and
for those out there watching, none of that is real. The Rock was like a mix of a nerve agent and a blister agent. And I don't want to get too far into it, but movies just aren't accurate in case you don't know.
Yeah. Inject right into the heart.
Never really did much more else other than creating the...
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
It is.
If you're doing your job, it's bad news.
Exactly. Yeah.
What are some of the common challenges you face in NBC? I know that obviously, especially in the initial invasion, you're working with outdated equipment. I'm sure there's a lot of old methodologies that you're implementing into a brand new war front. So what are some challenges that you kind of had to, MacGyver through?
Dealing with Vietnam era equipment.
Mm. Yeah.
My statement as a Lance Corporal and Corporal at the time were, I can go to Home Depot and get something better for a quarter of the price.
Yeah.
Can we just go do that? And it was like, no, we have to carry these 500-pound Senators that have an old Briggs & Stratton motor on them and eventually create hot water if the boiler works. You know, stuff like that. Just dealing with trash equipment.
Okay.
And for the most part, we were warehousing. And then when we were deployed, it was managing severe boredom. You know, most military people, if when you're bored, you're going to do one of two things: sleep, smoke, or dip. And, and that's it. So we did a lot of sleeping, smoking, and dipping.
Oh, so typical Marine experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Outdated, underfunded, bored.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But bored Marines are good Marines, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, boredom is beautiful.
And then when they take the leash off, you run.
Could not agree more. So you wrap up your service. You did 4 years in the Marines, right?
I did, yeah.
What was, so as you're transitioning out, you didn't have any intention of reenlisting? Was there animosity? Was there a reason that you decided to get out, or you just wanted to move on?
I just saw the leadership ahead of me, especially in that MOS. I worked with some very good leaders and then some very, very bad leaders. And I knew the good leaders had just a few years left, and then we were going to be stuck with the ones that I didn't necessarily agree with. So I saw no really solid career path staying in. And I was offered a chance to lateral into NCIS because I was going out and knew I was going to go into law enforcement. And that's probably one, I mean, obviously I'm happy with my life now and everything worked out the way it was supposed to. That's one, if you have a regret, that would have been pretty cool.
Yeah,
it was going to be an immediate promotion to sergeant, immediate selection for staff once you're there, working in civilian clothes out of San Diego. Like, sounds pretty cool looking back. But then it was like, you know, there's something about Texas. If you're in the military, you know the Texas guys. The guys let you know that they're from Texas.
And they do.
Just wanted to come home.
Sure.
And why I wanted to leave beautiful San Diego to come back to Texas, I don't know. I just love this place.
Yeah. In hindsight, it sounds a little crazy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Normal side, it sounds pretty crazy. But.
Yeah.
But,
so, yeah, leadership was the main reason why I got out.
Okay.
Yeah. And how is that transition out for you?
Can I go back just a second?
Of course.
So we talked about the NBC not having a role. We had a chief warrant officer at the time, and I'm not going to say his name, but he saw bored NBC Marines, Seaburn Marines, and he basically voluntold. You heard of voluntelling somebody to
of
do something?
Of course. I was in the Air Force, never heard
so
of it.
So he decided to lateral everybody over into mortuary affairs. So that was right at the end of the initial invasion. So we're talking June of, maybe even a little bit earlier, June of 03. So bored NBC Marines became mortuary affairs. Mm-hmm. And looking back now, that's such a huge mistake. Because to be a mortician or to pick up a leg and find it with the right arm and the right Marine or body, that's something you have to want to do. You can't just really be told to do it. Yeah. And I was so fortunate because when I got out, I got out right when we got back. So I thought I was going to get stop lost. I didn't get stop lost.
Okay.
I was out in January of 2004, but I was home on terminal leave in December while everybody else went back, and they went back as mortuary affairs. Mm-hmm. And I'm so blessed to this day that I didn't do that, because the guys that I was with that did go back, we lost one, and we'll get into that later. And we have others holding on by a hair, because processing that mentally is not something a normal person can do.
Yeah, you're not
especially when
for
you're
it.
Told to do it. So I didn't even know that was happening, but I'm so fortunate and blessed that I didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah, if you're not prepped for something like that, it is. And I've put bodies and parts of bodies in bags before dozens of times. Mm-hmm. And if you're not prepped for it, it's something that will weigh on you very heavily.
Yeah,
very heavily. Yeah. Yeah. So I can absolutely see that. If you're not prepped for it, it can affect you long term.
Yeah. So tell me, remind me of the questions you used.
I think that's a great kind of preface to, you know, transitioning out, because you're dealing with a job that you don't want to do, right? Voluntold to do this in a very high stress kind of situation, right? I mean, even infantrymen are not, you know, for the most part on a daily basis, tasked with going to do body retrievals.
Yeah, exactly.
It just doesn't happen.
But it's a very important job. I mean, getting that Marine back to their family.
Leave no man behind.
With every part that you can find. That is so impactful and important.
It is. And my comment and question was, you know, holding on to that extra burden as well and transitioning out of the military, how did you fare mentally?
I was blessed. I have zero empathy. I have to almost fake empathy on a regular basis just because I don't, my brain doesn't process things in a negative way. I might've been okay in that. I might not have been okay in that, but I just, yeah, I don't, things don't sit with me a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm able That's good. Store it away, pack it away and move
on. So you were able to pretty much jump right into law enforcement.
Yeah, a little stint as a bodyguard for Ross Perot, which was a really, really cool experience.
Yeah,
I was the first time Mike Thornton, who y'all have got to get on the podcast. He's a Medal of Honor winner. He pulled into Ross Perot's gate, and I see his Medal of Honor around his neck, and I gave him a hand salute, and that was a really terrible hand salute. A hand salute, and I asked him, I met him several years later. I was like, you remember that security guard, bodyguard that hand saluted? He's like, yeah. I was like, that was me. But it was fun working for Ross. He was an absolutely phenomenal leader and great guy. And
I've heard good things about him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, oh, he was great. underneath him, his main guy was retired Dallas police, and he talked me into going to the Dallas Police Department. I was like, I've already been to war. Don't really want to go back.
Sure.
So I'd rather go to like a little suburb and do that kind of law enforcement and just kind of ride the gravy train with biscuit wheels out of here. He's like, you're going to the Dallas Police Department. So I did. And two of us that worked for Ross at the time went to DPD. We were one class apart from each other. I was the second class that allowed, instead of having a bachelor's degree, allowed veterans to come in, which drastically changed the police department. Getting people with common sense and combat experience and totally changed it. Because before it was like the FBI. It was, no offense FBI people, but we didn't allow y'all to take your gun out of your holster if we were on our operation with you, because I don't want to get shot by a federal agent. So it was just very poorly run the way they promoted people. So anyway, adding military in was huge for the department.
Sure. Yeah. So did you have goals or intentions when you were joining the police department? Obviously you went in to the detective route eventually.
I did.
But did you have a goal or a desire, a direction you wanted to head with that? Or were you just leaving the options open?
I left the options open. I wanted to see which aspect I liked. So when I first got into law enforcement, I loved finding, catching, and stalking and putting property thieves in jail, burglars, you know, stuff like that. It was really cool. My first call ever on the police department. I'm first time sitting in a squad car. We got a call and my trainer was old, not lazy, but had already seen it, done it, didn't want to do the fun things. The first call was a barricaded person. So somebody locked in a house with a gun to somebody's head. And I was like, let's go, let's go, let's go. And he's like, nah, we're too far away. I was like, lights and siren. I started driving. He's like, okay. So we went. So my first call ever, I held somebody at gunpoint with a shotgun and it was like, okay, I can get behind this. Yeah. It was fun. So yeah, we did that. And I chased property crimes and thieves and stalking the burglars, deep nights. You know, deep nights is where law enforcement happens. It's the only people out are drunks, actual people working, and thieves. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that are out. So that just turned into that hobby. That then
What's the like high time for activity? 3 a.m. about?
Yeah. Depending on, we usually try to stay off main roads around the 2, unless you're doing DWIs, because you don't want to get hit by a drunk. Worst thing you can do is be working a traffic accident on the highway. My squad was hit 3 times by drunks on the highway in Dallas. Pulled over. Around the 1:30 to 3 o'clock time
frame.
How
do you justify that one? You don't. Just running into a police officer while drunk.
I saw the lights and drove right towards him.
So brief, I'll make this as brief as possible. So this is the stupidest guy I've ever met. Well, that's a big statement. One of the stupidest. it was an ice storm. So working downtown Dallas, you know, a lot of the highways are elevated. So anytime it's wet and cold, they freeze over and they just don't ever prepare for it. Maybe they're better now. I don't go to Dallas unless I have to, but, so it's a blanket of ice. We had 3 rows of flare lines closing the highway, getting everybody off the exit. Then we had about 6 squad cars lined up, making sure if you didn't see all the flare lines, you would see the squad car flashing lights. And this is before LED. So it was the spinning lights and not as bright as they are today. Well, this guy drove over the flare lines around squad cars. And we're sitting in this car. We've been in it for hours. So the windows are fogged up. And I was like, hey, Bill, that's headlights coming up. So we thought it was another squad coming up just to come over and BS and talk with us. So he rolls the window down. It wasn't. It was It was a car. And the guy drove straight into our car and hit us. And if you've seen the movies, this part's actually accurate. We all evacuated our vehicles. And while we could have opened the door, we decided to pull him out the window, the driver's side window. Turned out he was about 6'6" and 270 pounds. So it took a little longer to get him out the window than we planned. But he was rolling a joint in his lap when he hit us.
What?
So it was weed everywhere.
And idiot.
So that was a DWI that we actually won. He was a chef that got off work and was drinking and then rolling a joint on the way home and just kind of on cruise control, I guess. You know, it's before texting, so he wasn't texting. But
yeah. Just drove right into you guys.
Yeah,
huh?
It didn't hit us hard, just like a little thunk, you know.
But you idiot. What was his response? My bad.
It was the total stoner. Like, I didn't see you. Like three rows of flare lines and squad cars everywhere.
Flashing lights. Yeah. There's no one else around.
And you're on a blanket of ice, right? And he was going the wrong direction to get home. So that story never added up.
Yeah.
What's the justification? What's his reaction? Sorry, man.
Yeah. My bad.
Sorry,
yeah,
bro. So I'm sure that you've had quite a bit of interesting stops along the way. What is maybe a one-liner that you just got sick of hearing? Which, you know, like,
these aren't my pants.
That is so freaking accurate.
These aren't my pants.
These are not my pants. Well, whose pants are they? I don't know. I just woke up and put them on. So that's a good transition into the drugs. Because as I started chasing these burglars, all the burglars were dope heads. They were doing crack, meth, heroin, not so much because they're just in a vegetative state.
A little lazier then.
But meth, when they want something,
sack of potatoes,
they'll go steal. They'll burglarize their grandmother's house.
Oh yeah.
That's a big one.
So you nailed it. These aren't my pants. There's so many of those like little simple, like, What's this in your pocket? I don't know. These aren't in my pants.
Yeah.
It happened. It's unbelievable.
Which is just silly.
Yeah.
Just, I believe you.
Yeah.
I believe you.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I'm stoned. These aren't my pants.
Yeah.
You can't prove they are.
I don't know. There's hard to pull an exact one line, but that's up there on the list. So I started getting into chasing dope. And we call it chasing dope for a reason because you can't just sit there and wait for it. You can make a dope arrest every now and again, but. And I never really had a problem with marijuana and still don't to this day. But I used marijuana as I started getting in because it's believable with my stature build that I would be a marijuana smoker.
Sure.
And less believable that a white fat guy with black Oakleys would be buying crack. Now,
fair enough.
I was able to train that later as I got into my undercover career. But so started chasing dope in a uniform capacity. You're just waiting for the right cars.
And how that transition happened though, from beat to detective work?
Like, same thing as Marine Corps boredom. I was working downtown Dallas and my partner Dave Wascom and I would sit under a bridge at 3 a.m., smoke a cigar and just sit there and talk with a couple other officers. Because downtown Dallas, once the bars are done and the homeless get into their encampments, not a whole lot happens around then. Burglars aren't even out at that time.
Yeah,
occasionally, sure. But you'll wait for an alarm call and that's when you can go out and get around them. So we got really bored and we made kind of the same way I joined the Marine Corps. Like went to the recruiter, 2 weeks later I was in boot camp. Sorry, Mom. we're gonna go to Northeast Dallas where it's a little bit more hot and you know, more apartments, creates more drama. And this was an area that was a beautiful area before Katrina. And then all the apartment complexes opened up their arms to the Katrina evacuees and they took over the complexes and then they couldn't get rid of them and it destroyed the area for the most part. There was some good, but for the most part, they were pretty bad. So that's when we really started chasing the dope and intentionally going after the dealers. So in a uniform capacity, we could get a guy pulled over, you know, get consent to search the car. It is unbelievable how many people give you consent to search the car. hey, do you have anything in the car I need to know about? Bombs, guns, hand grenades, dead bodies, anything like that? That statement I used a million times. And no, you mind if I take a look? Nah, go for it.
And then you'd find something.
Yeah.
But what they don't
sometimes
know.
Sometimes find big things.
I'm going to educate people real quick. You can revoke consent.
You can.
And when you do that, they can no longer search it. Just going to educate the public real quick.
Let's
give
correct.
Consent, how about just a rule of thumb? Always say no.
Yeah.
That. I mean, if you have something to hide, for the most part, you know, but
even
to
if
correct you,
you
a little
even
bit,
if you don't,
we
say no.
We can still search with probable cause.
Yeah, probable cause. If you smell like weed or
if you're moving,
there's meth in the car. Yeah.
Like, if you're moving a bird of cocaine, a kilo of cocaine, you probably shouldn't be smoking a blunt while driving down the road.
Yeah.
It safe will blow your mind how many people are smoking a blunt while driving a kilo of cocaine down the road.
I've listened to it.
Because guess what we have now? We don't need your consent. Your consent's nice, but we have probable cause.
Yeah, I can look all I want now. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like the NFL player smoking weed. You're going to make $10 million to $100 million. Your career is going to be 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. Don't smoke weed while you're doing it.
Yeah, just don't.
Live your life. Yeah. I know it hurts.
Just wait a little bit.
And now we can get into the medical side of marijuana on that too, but you know, don't sacrifice your life for something like that.
Yeah, of course, anytime. And I want to ask you kind of a pointed question. Yeah. And why dope? And why drugs? Why not focus on a different area? What were you drawn to about that? And why did you make that decision instead of a different focus?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. It goes pretty deep with me. Mm-hmm. When I was very young, my brother, we don't know for sure, because my dad never told us, and I never got the death records, but my brother's and our belief is that my brother died of a cocaine overdose. With maybe a mixture of other things.
Okay.
So I always had a tie to putting hard drug dealers in prison.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Totally understand. Yeah. Totally understand. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, yeah. That was my draw.
Okay.
And that was the why. And then, you know, would work our way up. So
sure.
Get one guy on the street, mm-hmm. roll him in the uniform capacity. Who'd you buy it from? Call him up right now. Yeah. And then would work them as a confidential informant and do it the right way. You're not just letting them go. And then they could work their case off and call up the next guy. And we'd do 3 or 4 flips a night and work our way up and then get the moderately big guy. I mean, to get the big guy, you got to be UC and deep. But
sure, put some work in.
But yeah, your day might be an 8-hour shift. It might be a 3 or 4 day shift with no sleep and flipping and working, and which is fun when you're doing it.
Can you talk about that process? Yeah. So you made your entry into narcotics work as a detective.
Yeah.
Talk about that work.
I was about 4.5 years on the street.
Okay.
And I just became known. When we made that move to Northeast, Dave and I became known as go-getters and hard workers. So we started writing our reports really good. We were recruited by a CRT sergeant who fine-tuned us and really trained us. Barry Ragsdale, freaking phenomenal leader, phenomenal sergeant.
CRT?
CRT, crime response team.
Okay.
But we were kind of property crimes, but we were super focused on dope.
Okay.
And his training led us to become very, very good. When we'd write a police report or arrest report, we wrote a prosecution report, better than most detectives did. So when we had a case, they pled out. We very rarely went to court because it was detailed. We took pictures. Like we were our own crime scene. We did all that stuff. So when it came time to get recruited by the undercover division, narcotics I was lucky. I got the job within 5 years on the department, which is kind of rare, especially for somebody of my me
flavor.
Yeah, my flavor. So we got in, started in street squads. I stayed in street squads, which was a blast, man, because. Would either do a confidential informant buy or an undercover buy, and then go back with 10 of our buddies and kick the door in. We're our own entry team, and it was the best job I've ever had because we got to do it all.
You got to
do everything from the buy
to
writing the warrant.
Yeah.
You try to get a warrant for the individual, and then you get a warrant for the house. You go talk to the judge. You prepare your warrant team. Mm-hmm. We get surveillance on the house. And this is all in a shift. So you get surveillance on the house, and then you pull up in our van in full entry gear and hit the door. And I started at the back of the stack. One of our first warrants I got shot at. It was a hairy one, but it was, you know, we were support on that one. And
can you walk through that start to finish?
Which part?
That whole situation, like from making initial contact, making the initial, and then walking through the actual operation.
Sure. Yeah. So we usually get a complaint. So if you think your neighbor's selling dope, that complaint comes into the city. We investigate it, legitimize it. Is it a real complaint? Is it not a real complaint? Is it just somebody that?
And is that a lot of observation? just watching, or yeah, is it confrontation?
Start with surveillance for the most part, and see if you could substantiate it. Then you either go in with a informant, or you go in on your own. Okay. Our informants were just easy. If you're buying a crack rock or something like that, they knew, you know, if you smell weed, buy weed. If you don't smell weed, buy crack. You know, okay, depending on the area. If it's a heroin area, you buy heroin, stuff like that. So, yeah, you go from surveillance. You either go in and get a buy, you send a CI in to get a buy, and then you might do a couple of them at different times a day to see when it's up, when it's down, because they have to get re-upped, right? So somebody drops off a cookie, which is a cookie, a crack, basically the bottom of a Pyrex container, like the measuring device.
Okay.
That's how they finish the cook. And they'll chop that up and they'll deliver that to the house. And when they have it, they have it. When they don't, they don't. They're up and down. So you have to decide when they're up and when they're down. Typically, if it's one that we do and say they're stupid and put a gun to your head or something like that, we'll go back and hit it same day. And if it's a really hairy one, say we see AKs, ARs, stuff like that, that's something that for safety, we would refer to the SWAT team and they'll do a surrounding call out or something like that.
Just
because nobody wants to die over a crack rock.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in that, it's all building your case from the beginning, documenting everything, reports, detailed reports. And then once you have enough evidence, you go ahead and get the search warrant and prep our team, go in and get in the stack and hit the house. So the way we did warrants then were different than the way they do them now. It worked. It worked every time, but it was very unsafe the way they do it now. We would pull up, get out of the van, flashbang or distractionary device, rake and break a window. We would have that house cleared within about 3 minutes of pulling up to the house.
Okay.
So yeah, everybody down, everybody on the ground, handcuffed, carrying them out within 3 minutes. So very effective. But it was basically like, if you want to summarize, it was like Marines hitting a house. Like,
yeah.
So, go!
Yeah.
And then you just go and unload and get in there and...
Yeah.
So it was, the way we did it was fun.
Sure.
I think more fun than the way they do it now, but safe isn't always the most fun.
And so is it more safety focused now?
Yes. And I don't know all the tactics now, but the way they do it is they train a lot with SEALs and with different branches of the military. I can't remember the name of the company in Dallas, but they train with them and it's moving with a partner and stepping and continuing through the house where before it was, number one guy goes to the first threat, number two, and you're number two. Yeah. So number one guy's rifle, number two's pistol. Pistol goes hands on, rifle holds gun down. And you just team up and go through until the house is secure.
Which now it's moving an ample amount of time.
Sir?
Adds a lot of time.
Yeah, it does. And you know, if you do your case right, you should have an in-hand warrant for a person before you get there. Before it was just hit the house and get what you can get and do your interviews, and usually there's a dealer or a user in there with the guy that's operating the house.
Okay.
And it gets fun.
Yeah. But
they, nothing too terribly hairy on that.
I'm curious about the intel gathering portion. So I know quite a few detectives. One of my best friends is a narcotics detective, homicide detective. And intel gathering... These days, I mean, he's perusing Craigslist, he's perusing Facebook Marketplace to find open buys, right?
Mm-hmm.
You did that before the internet was obviously around, but wasn't as prevalent then, right? Well, how did you guys go about your intel gathering? Because I imagine it was more human gathering by signals gathering or you know, internet.
We used Facebook. Right? That was one of the main ones.
Okay. So you were still using it?
Yeah, we used... every resource we had. So Facebook, if we'd arrested somebody before and they gave consent for their phone or we got a warrant for their phone, when we download the phone, we get everything.
Okay.
Everything.
All right.
So you got to go through that and you can build your case based on that too.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's just getting in with people and, you know, not being a dick.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in uniform, it was building a relationship. Mm. Undercover, it's building a relationship. It's getting to know you, and even though you're only in the house for a minute, you can still bullshit somebody and get good information out of them. And
sure,
treating them like a human. Once they're arrested and they're getting interviewed, treat them right. You know, they're in a bad spot. They know they're going to go to jail. There's no need to be a dick. You already won.
Yeah.
So if you're nice, you will get more information from them than you would have before.
Sure.
So yeah, well, every resource we have. Now we were before fentanyl then.
Yes.
Fentanyl was almost non-existent. I never came across it. I left in 2016. Yeah. I never came across it once. If we did, we didn't know what it was.
So fentanyl was the big issue.
It wasn't when I was there.
Okay.
It is now. What we dealt with for the most part then was your majors. Yeah. Heroin, crack, cocaine, methamphetamine, mm-hmm. You know, mollies, all that. That was what we were after.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you like to call it tame then. The drugs were tame then. Mm-hmm. Did we lose so many people now to fentanyl? It's unbelievable. And the only ones you hear about are the movie stars. And how many of them are dropping on a daily basis?
Too
it's
many.
Wild.
I mean, what would we have over 150,000 overdoses last year from mm-hmm. fentanyl directly?
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's one every 5 minutes in the U.S.
And they're cutting it into heroin. And cocaine, which is making it just uber dangerous.
Yeah, and you have no idea what you're getting.
Yeah.
Like parents with kids, I don't know how you explain this. I've got a 10-year-old that I'm trying to figure out how to have that conversation, because when I was a kid, you just kind of, I mean, pot was pot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's just pot. Like the pot in 1995 and the pot now is vastly different.
Terribly different.
Like, nobody's ever died from it, but you know, I heard Ron White say every now and again, you got to get so high you think you're going to die just so you get a good, so you know you have a good buzz. But
yeah. Yeah. That's
I'm not
fair.
A proponent of it. I'm just saying.
That's fair.
It's what Ron White said, not
fair.
Me. But it's so different now, and you don't know what you're going to get. And
it's
you got to realize that when it comes into the country, it's been stepped on probably 10 or 15 times before it even crosses the border. Mm-hmm. And then it stepped on again and cut and cut and cut because they want to make that kilo go longer and longer and longer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you don't know what they're cutting it with.
Yeah. What's the purest and the most unpure range that you've seen?
The one way to tell, I don't want to give a class on how to know good cocaine, but
give a class.
Usually fresh off the block. So if it's a powder form, it's probably been stepped on a bunch. If it's, we call it fish scale, where it's chipped off the block and it kind of has a scale to it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually that's better, but okay. I don't know where they're doing. Like again, I was before fentanyl, so I don't know at what phase that they're adding that into the cup.
I mean, but you hear just horror stories about like rat poison, all this stuff just being cut into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to give the burn, I believe. I don't know. I'm not an expert on the actual drug itself, but never done it. Don't ever plan on doing it.
That's for an intent.
Yeah.
To give a burn.
And the cut. Yeah. So as far as I understand. Yeah. And somebody out there will tell me I'm an idiot, but I'm not going to read the comments.
Never read the comments.
So anyway, we get back to like finalizing the case.
Mm-hmm.
You're building a presentation to a jury from the beginning to the end. So you want to be able to say, this is where it started. This is where we went. This is where this happened. And then post that we did an interview and they corroborated, admitted, didn't admit, or we flipped them and they did something else.
Okay.
The goal was that we don't need to go to trial because we've got a lock solid case. Mm-hmm. And when our jail sergeants read the reports, they're like, God, your reports are so long. Your narcotics reports are so long. Just make it short. When I got there, it was AO, arresting officer, observed so-and-so and conducted a search of the human finding in the right front pocket methamphetamine.
Basic.
That long a report.
One sentence.
Our reports were like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's two places where you want to have accurate reports, and that's, you know, being in a police officer and a medical doctor. They have to be, because the amount of backlash that you could face if that's not correctly observed. And two, how often is it maybe a year, two, 3 years of litigation and you have to recall that event, right? Mm-hmm. And the more gaps you have in that.
You have to, and on top of that, not just me recalling, if you're the prosecutor when we make the arrest, I give you the prosecution report. Okay, good. You've heard from me exactly what the case was. Well, in the court system, you're moved to this court and then you replace him and then you move to this court and you're replaced and you might be four or five prosecutors down or mm-hmm. more by the time we're actually going to trial.
Okay.
And they have to be able to read the report and understand everything.
Yes.
I mean, down to the weather of the day. You know, they need to be able to present the jury with a clear picture of what it was. Because you'll never remember if when you pulled up, it was foggy when you hit the house.
Sure.
And why you couldn't see them in the back corner of the yard. You have to be able to explain all that.
Yeah. It's the My Cousin Vinny thing, right? Yeah. How thick are your glasses? Those are Coke bottles.
Now, fun story. We hit a house. This is one of my favorite. It's not like that great, but we hit this house. And as we go in, they're watching the first 48 on TV. And it's at the interview process where they're in, this is in Dallas, because the first 48, a lot of it was filmed in Dallas.
Okay.
They're interviewing this guy and he's giving his, admitting to this murder, right? And then we look and he's got all the first 48s on DVD, all of them, study material, right? So we get to the interview phase. This guy's been studying. Does he give a statement or does he not give a statement? Did he ask for an attorney or did he give a statement?
I bet he asked for an attorney. Oh, he gave a statement.
Poured his heart out. He told us everything.
Spilled the beans.
I was like, you've been studying. You wasted all that time watching the first 48.
Big fat F on this test.
So yeah, it was like, man. And, you know, I'd go back after the interview and go in and talk with him and BS with him and like, dude, why?
Yeah.
Like, you could have. We read your Miranda warning.
Do you tell them that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, you know, you just gave everything away, right?
Everything, yeah.
You buried yourself, dude.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, that's sometimes part of the fun of the job.
Sure. Yeah.
And we're still recording. So that part's still given to the jury if they want to see it. So, it was ultimately, it was the most fun job I've ever had, but the most unfair job I ever had for my family. Mm-hmm. So at the time, my daughter was born. She was about one and a half, and I'll try to be brief on the story, but it's a real story. We came in, I was training a new guy, Paul. I'm not gonna say his last name because I don't know if he wants to be out there, but I was training him. We did a confidential informant buy on this house. We're back at the office processing the dope, and our sergeant comes to us and he's like, hey, Chief wants a hard drug warrant on that house for us to hit tomorrow. I need you to go back out and buy meth. We're like, well, the CI bought weed on this one. So I'm not going to send back and get meth because we don't know that they sell it. So, well, I'll go back and get a weed buy.
Sure.
We'll do it tomorrow. I mean, he's brand new and he's already 8-9 hours into the shift and already tired and learning. You know, when you're learning, your brain's just mush, right?
Absolutely.
So he says, no, I want him to go back and I want him to get a hard drug buy at that house. So I was like, I'm against this.
Yeah.
Against
you're
it.
Gonna blow
Do
this.
Not want it.
Yeah.
And it was basically not an option. So this is a chief telling us what we're going to do as detectives, a chief that hasn't done the job telling us what to do as a detective. And I said, okay, we'll do it. But we're going to take a full rescue team with us if we're going to do it. I want a slammer. I want rifles. I want heavy gear. If we're going to do it, that's what we're going to do. Thinking he's going to go, can't put it together. We'll do it tomorrow. Like, I did everything we could to do this tomorrow. So he says, okay, I'll get you your team together. So we went out and we had our device that was allowed everybody to listen. And he goes up and it's a back door entry. So you're not at the front door. So we can't see anything. I pulled our car all the way to the back of the driveway. He goes up and they knew he was police the second he walked in the door. He went in and asked for meth. He's never asked for meth before because he didn't know what he was doing because I told him he didn't know what he was doing. And he tried to get a teenth of meth and it wasn't a meth house. It was a weed house. And they knew he was a cop. They shoved a shotgun in his mouth and I could hear him, or his word was, don't rob me, man. Please don't rob me. I got a family. Don't rob me is the heads up to us. We got a situation here.
Yeah.
When you're in fear for your life, I have a family. I got chicken skin telling the story.
Yeah.
And I have the full audio recording of it too. I gotta be careful what I tell in the story too. So he says, don't rob me. I've got a family. So I know this is bad. So I get out and I told everybody else, hey, I'm going to the door as a distraction. And the whole house is camered. Cameras on every corner. So I'm in plain clothes, knocking on the door, like, hey, man, we got to go. Let's go, man. My old lady's waiting for me, stuff like that. And I can hear them yelling inside, yelling at him, you're a cop, you're a cop. We're going to kill you, you're a cop. And I started knocking harder. I'm like, and I'm hoping my team's coming like really quickly. Mm-hmm. While I'm there observing this door, it is a steel door with a steel frame, which if you've ever kicked a door in, steel frames and steel doors are the least favorite to kick.
Sure.
You can almost go through the brick faster. So one, I'm glad we have a slammer that's coming up, and I'm glad we have an entry team. So it took, I don't know how many minutes it took to get in that door. But as the team came up, obviously we're in full police gear at this point, or they are. They came up. Rescue team was awesome. They threw my heavy vest over me. At the time, I was using a SIG P226 with freaking, 8 rounds in it? Like, that's my undercover gun?
Yeah.
Fuck that. I'm so glad that the guns, like, the subcompacts are so much better now. It's unbelievable. So we start hitting the door. We went through 3 slammers to get in. Because it's exhausting swinging it, going from hinge to doorknob side. It ended up being a double barn door barricaded steel door, steel frame.
Wow.
As we go in, we're going in the back door. So kitchen's on the right, dining room, living room's on the left. There's like a little window into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I'm going straight into the next threat. I go straight. Paul is there. As soon as we make entry, he pulls his gun. And I didn't mention that they took his phone and ran to the back of the house. The main guy took his phone and ran to the back of the house once we started hitting it. So I'm going this way. I watch my sergeant go. He dives through the little window into the kitchen. It's just an open, TV can't see what we're looking at, but dives through it and tackles a guy midair. Like one of the most amazing tackles I've ever seen. If it was on ESPN, Sim Woodham gets the highlight reel of the day, right? So he goes through the window. I go around and there's like a little box dining room. So living room, box dining room, and then family room on the other side. So as I'm rounding that corner, the guy with the shotgun's rounding the corner the other way. And there's nothing else in this room. And I am at his face, pulling my gun. We're about 8 feet away. I'm pulling the trigger, pulling the slack out of the trigger, and I'm looking at him, and his finger goes on trigger at my face with a sawed-off shotgun. Mm-hmm. And by the grace of God, I am one hair from this gun going off, 357 to the dome he was going to take, and I'm going to take a shotgun probably at the same time. I watch his finger come off the trigger, his hands go like this, and he shoves the gun and it skips across the room. And at that point, the fight was on. But he knew he didn't want to die.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I say the hand of God came down and saved both of our lives, because you can't be closer to dying and killing somebody than that right there. We're so close. I mean, at that point, we were 2 feet away when he does this. But the ability to see his hands, fingers come out. I can still see it. His fingers come out and he shoves the gun. And I remember the sound of it skipping across the floor, and then you know, he valiantly fought and lost. And then there's parts of the story I can't tell. And we secured the house. It was also a daycare.
Wow! So they had a
group of children in the background. So they were selling dope, running a daycare, all in a regular residential neighborhood.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that day, nobody died.
Wow.
Which was
victory.
Unbelievable.
That's a win. Died
there. And you know, how was your partner who went in first?
I bet he still probably struggles a little bit with it. But yeah. That was...
And the chief's response.
Yeah, that was
question. You know, that's why I transitioned out of the police department. Because it never came up. They never acknowledged anything, never said anything positive, negative.
I would not have been able to help myself with an "I told you so, sir."
Yep.
That happened.
Not, yeah?
Good.
Yeah. I let that be known. Yeah. And I let him know that that's why I was leaving. And I continued to work for a little while. I had a really interesting...
They just said thanks for your service. Good luck.
You know, I had a really interesting eye issue. My right eye, because we did so many entries a day. We got to the point where I worked my way up the stack. So I ended up being, when I finished, I was the number one guy, the point guy with a rifle. So when the door opens, I'm calling if we're going to throw a bang or, you know, directing everybody where we're going to go. So we were doing 3-4 warrants a day, sometimes more. And that's the equivalent of jumping out of an airplane 3 or 4 times a day. So I was at such a high level of cortisol that it was bleeding into my retina. So from the center of the vision of my right eye, it was a black dot. And that black dot kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where I was like, hey, I've got to go get this checked out. Because if you're holding a gun on that side of the house and I'm looking directly at you, I can't see the gun. I don't know if there's anything in your hand. I was like, hey, guys, I don't need to be doing these warrants. I can't see. Mm-hmm. And they didn't believe me. Whatever it was, I had a medical diagnosis. I took leave. And while I was on the leave, I had a good friend of mine, John Sharkey, who was a phenomenal dude. He was in real estate school. And he's like, hey, dude, this isn't for me. It is for you. And I think you need to do it. I was like, I have nothing. Again, like military, law enforcement, narcotics, I had nothing better to do. So fuck it. I'll do it.
Give it a shot.
So while I was on leave, I skipped out that the retina specialist said, you know, you're either going to go blind or you're not. And the only way we can counteract this is pulling you out of stressful environments for 60 days and reevaluating it, see if it got better.
Okay.
And it did. It got better. But in that time, I took all my real estate school and knew I wasn't going back. Mm. So fascinating part, before I took that leave, they still kept putting me on warrants, even though I was telling them, no, I don't need to be on warrants. I don't need to be on, I cannot see a gun. I mean, it got to the point where it's as big as your head when I'm looking at you. And we're 5 feet away.
That's a problem.
6 feet away. And just the overall lack of leadership, again, why I left the military, the lack of solid, consistent leadership is why I left. And then right after I left, and nobody asked me to stay. You know, detectives did. They're like, dude, stay. You know, we're buddies. We're brothers, sisters. You know, we're as tight as you can be. But nobody from above the sergeant level ever asked me to stay. Mm. They have millions of dollars in training me. Nobody said, hey, can we put you somewhere else? Is there anywhere we can use you that would be better? More of an investigative role? Nobody. I wouldn't have stayed anyway.
Sure.
It was...
Felt a little disposable.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, thanks for your service.
Yeah.
Fuck you. So...
That probably reinforced your decision.
Absolutely. Yeah. And every decision I've made somehow has just... I'm blessed that it just worked out.
Yeah.
I got into real estate, and another kind of funny story on that quick transition. Why did I get out of real estate? Tired of getting shot at. I was shot at more in the city of Dallas than I was in Iraq. Mm. So my first showing ever, I'm showing for another agent. It was an 8 a.m. in the morning, real estate showing on a Saturday morning. I called the agent the night before, said, hey, I'm showing this at 8 a.m. on Saturday. I know it's earlier than normal. Please make sure your clients know. So we go up, and I transition from police knock, depending on who's listening, from thump, thump, thump to realtor. did that, get the key, unlock the door. We walk in and I can see dishes and stuff sitting on the countertop. I was like, in my keen observation skills, I would think if you're selling a house of this quality, you would clean up your dishes before showing.
Typically.
Yeah. So my hairs are standing up, but I'm like, hey, this is the first time I've ever done this. I don't know what this is supposed to look like. I know how I would do it. So we're walking through, get to the master bedroom, husband and wife still in bed. Husband rolls over, grabs a pistol, comes back up. I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I'm going to get shot my first day as a real estate agent.
Jesus.
And it ended up being wonderful. And we stepped out of the house for a minute. I was like, realtor, realtor, realtor. You know, like, Jesus, don't shoot me.
Yeah, please.
We backed out of the house, let them get out. They left, and the couple bought the house. So,
wow. Hey, that's a win.
So it was, and that has not happened again since, thankfully. So,
well, that's good.
I did transition back to the police knock.
So, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, let them know.
You can hear a thud, thud, thud.
Yeah. I am here.
You know, quite the story. And obviously in conjunction with being a real estate agent, you started TVP.
Yeah. So fortunate to be good at real estate and sales in general. And that's something that first responders and military don't usually think about. You know, cops think, I'm really good at being a cop. Military is like, I'm really good at being an operator. I'm not good at anything else. They just stay in the career. Thank you to everybody that's out there that serves and works in the communities and makes communities better. But don't feel trapped, because if you can go on a family violence call and work through the guy that answered the door that just beat his wife and has her trapped in a bathroom, bleeding and potentially dying, and you can get to her, use your ability to build rapport and get to her, you can sell anything.
Sure.
You can sell anything. So sales is a great transition for law enforcement and military. And I didn't know that at the time. I just was lucky enough to find it out.
Sure.
So real estate, I was fortunate enough to become rookie of the year, top producing agent. And then I lost my buddy Slater, who was one of the, we talked about the mortuary affairs. Mm-hmm. Slater was a great guy. He was in a tank rollover, so it screwed his back up. So he was when he got out, he was given pills. Also, when he was mortuary affairs, he was accidentally trapped in one of the mobile morgues overnight with
my God,
with no lights and a bunch of dead Iraqis.
Jesus,
ooh, that's rough.
Yeah,
and he never recovered.
Yeah.
He went to the VA and he was blown up, and we believe he had TBIs. Sure. I didn't really know what TBIs were at the time. Yeah. We knew he had severe PTSD. I didn't know how severe, but when he got, the VA got him on all these painkillers and then they stopped giving them to him because he was abusing them because he was still in pain. He started self-medicating with heroin and well, can't say he took his own life, but his life ended with a needle in his arm.
Sure.
And again, being fortunate enough in real estate, I was able to put together a group to go to Biloxi for his funeral. And we're all sitting at that time. I said, we got to get behind something to stop this. Mm-hmm. So we supported 22 Kill, who's now One Tribe. I bought shirts for 22 Kill because it said One Tribe, One Fight, because that's what we are. We're One Tribe, we're One Fight. And I bought everybody the OD Green 22 Kill shirt, and we wore them the whole weekend in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Margaritaville Hotel restaurant and stuff. And we knew we had to do something and just didn't know what it was. Fast forward a few months, you know, if you're paying attention, God will let you know you're on the right path, right? Or whatever your being is that you believe in, mine's God.
Sure.
I call it God's thumbprint. It tells you you're on the right path, you're doing the right thing. So I knew I needed to do something. I knew that just supporting 22 Kill wasn't going to be it. It wasn't going to be good enough. So I get this random call from a lender in Colorado that I'm forced to work with. And real estate agents hate working with outside lenders that the buyer brings with them. Mm-hmm. So this guy's transitioning from Colorado Springs. The VA lender calls me and I'm like, dude, this guy really knows what he's talking about. This is Travis Cupp. Travis says in the same conversation, if you've ever met Travis, you can't get him to stop talking. He will talk and talk and talk until you're like, dude, I gotta go. Like, it's midnight. Like, my wife wants me to come home. So he's telling me, he's like, hey, my dad puts on this clay shoot for veterans. Would you like to do it? I was like, well, I'm a Marine, so I'm a terrible shotgun shooter, but I'll go. I'd like to go see it. So I go there. It was boot and shoot. If you've ever heard of boot and shooting, it's just a big sporting clay event that supports fallen veterans. And one of their charities is a group that does brain treatment for TBIs. Hmm. In that moment, I found out that there was not only that TBIs were treatable, but they were curable.
Yeah.
And I was like, I told Travis that day, I said, hey, we're doing this in Rockwall next year. And he's like, I guess I need to move from Colorado. I said, yeah. And he moved from Colorado.
Wow.
And we put it together. So Travis, my wife and I founded Texas Valor Project, and it started just as an idea. We just did everything we could, get cool items, make it as patriotic as possible in the hopes of raising money. Because to treat a brain, it's about $10,000. But it goes upwards to $15,000-$16,000. So
sure.
The average was 10. It used to be like between 8 and 12. Now it's really about, with everything we need to do, about $16,000. So you can't go out and raise $20,000 and treat one person. You can. Treating one person's great, but you need to be able to treat as many as you can. And one a year is not enough.
Yeah.
So we put it together, got some cool things, got the Marine Color Guard. The whole community came together, mm-hmm. and got behind us and helped us and supported us. 30 days prior to the event, we needed to raise enough money to put the event on, and we had raised no money. Mm. And we had a chair, somebody that was supposed to be the fundraiser. What I learned is somebody that's the fundraiser has to have the emotional buy-in that you have, otherwise you're not gonna get it.
Absolutely.
So, in about 2 weeks, I raised $135,000 to get the event put on.
Wow.
And then it was, well, let's hope we've got the right people.
Yeah.
So that one, on top of what it cost to put the event on, netted about $185,000.
Wow.
So
for your first event.
Yeah. Well, then we just wanted to be a fundraising arm of Coast to Coast Foundation and Defenders of Freedom.
Sure.
Both phenomenal organizations. Mm-hmm. And if you guys haven't talked to Donna Cranston with Defenders of Freedom, you've got to. She'll get into like the real part of the treatment. We just wanted to raise money for them, and to be able to write that check was like, this is it. This is the thing. And then we're like, okay, we're going to do it again next year. And you guys came out to that event this year. Thank you for coming. And it was fun. It's, you know, most of the people are like, I can't believe this is your first or second year. Well, we're just blessed to have the right people with us in the right community. Rockwall County has the most veterans per capita than any other county. I think the Granbury area is catching up with us or might have passed us, but we're working on getting back ahead of them.
Yeah,
we just have a great community. Populated. And they supported us. They saw the need. Most of them didn't know about TBIs and the cure for TBIs. The first time we talked, I said, it's just not talked about. You guys are like, no, it's talked about. You know, it's really becoming more prevalent. And I'm so happy it is. So the next event we did this year, we did right at $250,000.
Wow.
And nice. For a second year event, that's awesome.
That's fantastic.
It's great. Yeah. You know what? That treats 25 people if we can get it exactly at $10,000. That's not scratching the surface, guys. And we're not even scratching the surface. Yeah. There's hundreds of thousands of veterans. And we treat veterans and first responders because we're dumb and we're like, hey, let's treat more people. So it opened it up even more. And you know, now what we're dealing with is, one, we need more money. Two, we need a system to process them in. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to go onto a waiting list, if it takes 6 months, you're no better than the VA.
Yeah.
In case you don't know, the VA doesn't do their job. They have all the same equipment that our doctors do, and they're just not using it. And for them to treat one TBI, it takes about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And you're coming back every few months and this. And it just doesn't get it done. Our doctors do it in 2 weeks. So it's a full immersion into the system. You and I talked at the event that I was going to go through the treatment, mm-hmm. and I did.
Okay. What benefits have you noticed? What changes have you seen?
Let me start with the failures.
Okay.
Because you don't know what you're going to expect. Mm-hmm. I did a series of videos just on my phone, basically for me, so I would remember what my anxieties were. You know, my anxieties are driving to, we've got an Airbnb, Delta guy bought this. He went through it. He's like, I love this. This changed my life. He bought a house, turned it into an Airbnb for the three foundations, okay. Texas Valor Project, Coast to Coast, and Defenders of Freedom. So we can house our people within walking distance, like literally 100 yards to the treatment
That's
center.
Amazing.
So they just walk to treatment. And Zeke's unbelievable. Well, he loved it so much that he's now in school to become the doctor that treats.
Wow.
So my anxieties driving there were, am I worthy? There's so many people that need it more than me.
Sure.
I mean, I have a few TBIs, football, explosions, stuff like that, but I wasn't blown up, you know? So I always wanted to put people before me. And Donna convinced me, she's like, you need to go because you need to know what this does. And the last time we talked, I didn't know what it was. Yeah. I mean, I knew the basics of it, didn't know what the actual treatment was. And one of the things I found out is my wife, I told you then, my goal was to be a better husband, a better father, and a better leader, better person, be in control of my own ship, being mm-hmm. the captain of my own ship. What I did find out is my wife was kind of hoping I wouldn't be an asshole anymore, but it turned out I was an asshole before the brain injury. So, but I can see it now. So I can like really see that, oh yeah, what I did was not a proper way to mm-hmm. respond.
Yeah.
I got into counseling. I'm trying to lead by example, right? Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you need counseling.
And not go.
And not do it myself. I can't tell you need brain treatment and not go myself. I can't say that you know you're in good hands when I don't know you're in good hands. Mm-hmm. The doctors there are unbelievable. They don't dress in scrubs because they don't want you to feel like you're in a clinical environment. They talk to you like a human being. When they come up behind you, no operator likes anybody coming up behind them. They'll put their hand on your shoulder and roll the hand around, letting you know that they're going to come around that side of you. Everything from the way they touch, the way they dress, to the way they talk to you gives you a calming experience. Mm-hmm. And the Airbnb right there is even better because you don't start your day with sitting in traffic to get to the location.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't need to go into the, unless you want me to go into what all the treatment is. But my goal was to get, I told you, be a better husband, be a better father, be a better leader, be a better human. I had an issue. Remember I was telling you about the other eye issue? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This eye, I always felt, my left eye always felt like it floated a little bit. And when I'm talking to you, I'm distracted because I feel like you're looking at my floating eye. And my eye actually never floated, but it felt like I did. So it distracted me. So I couldn't pay attention to you if we're talking one-on-one. On the phone, perfect. In person, hard to make eye contact because it was a distraction. Mm-hmm. I got on the TMS machine and in the first 7 minutes, when it was on this, the left side of my head, stimulating my prefrontal cortex, the doctor, when she started talking to me afterwards, I was like, holy fuck, my eye's fixed.
Wow.
Like, it fixed.
Wow.
I was like, why is that? And I'm like, well, it's probably stimulated your ocular nerve that's right there. To this day, fixed.
Wow.
So now having this conversation, I'm not thinking about that, not distracted. Well, we looked at the science of it. My eye was trained. I trained it over time. This eye is close. This is the one I'm watching you with. This eye is watching the surroundings behind you. My left eye is watching the surroundings behind you. And the system showed, it showed you on paper that that's exactly what my eyes did. Hmm. So we did a lot of eye movement, stuff like that to work on that. The TMS is, I find very relaxing, very calming, and it stimulates your prefrontal cortex. We're actually going to use that with a different doctor on my son who's diagnosed with ADHD because they can take a child and use TMS on them to stimulate and mature the prefrontal cortex faster than it was before. So wow. Hopefully next time I check in with you guys, I can give you a child's example, a six-year-old's example of what TMS does.
I'd love to hear that.
But we're just scratching the surface on what this stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's great.
You're starting to see TMS talked about more,
yeah.
And it's unbelievable. Just everything, the way they work with the veterans and the different processes, everyone is treated differently. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a different TBI. So it's not a one size fits all. We're going to do this for everybody. It's this is your issues. And this is what we're going to focus on individually with you. Mm-hmm. You have a doctor assigned to you. It's either Dr. G or Dr. Iserman.
Yeah.
And they're with you, walking you through everything. And you're just calm and relaxed and feel good. And coming out, my vision's better. My mental health is better. Mm. In combination with counseling too.
Sure.
The diet, it's a complete control, alt, delete of your body. From your brain to your diet to everything. And the diet alone is great. And they use the blood type diet.
Okay.
So if you've ever heard of it, you know, I'm a type O, I'm lucky. I get to eat red meat and big green vegetables. If you're a type A, you get to eat the vegetables, some of them, you know. But it's feeding your body what it needs and doing a cellular reset over 6 months. Then you can start introducing things back in and seeing what makes you sick. I had a piece of cake the other day and I hadn't had flour. I can't eat flour. Well, I can eat flour on this diet. You're not supposed to eat flour.
Sure.
I had a piece of cake and I was sick for 2 days. So I was like, cake's off the list. It's probably good for the body.
Probably processed sugar. And
so
flour,
yeah, I haven't eaten really anything processed since treatment, but my clarity's great. My memory recall's great. I went in to get memories back as well. It's not like you get I'm saying this because the people that are going to go through. One, if you're suffering from a TBI, you deserve to take the time to yourself and do this treatment. Because it's selfish for you not. A lot of people feel it's selfish to do it. It's selfish for you not to do it because you owe it to yourself, most importantly to yourself and your family, to get yourself better.
Yeah.
So don't wait. Get on the list, get some sort of treatment. And while you're waiting to get there, do something for yourself, get in counseling. Understand that there's only two things we can control, mm-hmm. what we say and how we respond. That's it. Everything else is out of your control. So if you can control how you respond to a situation, you're dictating how that situation is going to go from there on out. And
fantastic.
You know, I'm overwhelmed with how great it is. And the memories I got back, it's not a flood. I was saying a second ago, it's not a flood of memories. But when I recall back to like playing golf with my dad when I was a kid, I would remember that we played golf, but that's it. Now I go back to recall that memory. I was wearing a red shirt. He was wearing a green shirt. Oh, we were wow. in a gray golf cart in Mauna Kea, Hawaii. It was a really cool experience. But my brain didn't remember any of that. I can remember some of the conversations we had now. Wow. And it's not like I get all these memories back. It's no, now you can recall them because you've opened up the neural pathways to get those back. And it's invaluable.
Yeah. We're going to definitely have to have Doc G on to go into detail about this therapy as well. But where can we find you at?
We're TexasValorProject.org. That's the charity's website. Perfect. And we're up and coming, and we're going to take this with a storm. And yeah. I'm hoping in the next few years, we'll be well over $1 million a year charity. We're 100% volunteer, and the people that work with us are just passionate about helping, and that's what we do.
That's fantastic.
Great.
So TexasValorProject.org is our website.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for sharing with us today, Chris. You have an extensive life history, and you've done some pretty incredible things, and we're really thankful that you chose to share today. So
I appreciate you guys having me on.
Thanks for your service in multifaceted areas.
You guys as well. Thank
you. Appreciate you for sharing.
This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today. Keep an eye out for the episodes next week and interact with the video somehow. Interact with the content. Leave a review, like, share, all that stuff. We do the same for you. See you next week.
Until next time.
Bye.